From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, talking with you about what's new in healthy living, sharing some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, you can call us right now at 800-462-7413. And Zorba, along with our call, some topics to talk about.
Yes, we're going to talk about sleepwalking and how it may run in the family and what it means if you sleepwalk and what it means for your children.
And?
Breastfed children, the risk of leukemia, some interesting new research.
Okay, and our recipe.
Grilled chicken salad with mango and avocado. Do you like avocado? Oh, I love avocado. Do you like mango?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. You know, I would have expected the opposite, Tom. I would have expected that you would love avocado and hate mango, but you never, ever fail to actually impress
me. It's always a surprise.
800-462-7413.
To the phones we go now, Zorba. Let's welcome a listener in Crossville, Tennessee. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Fine. How can we help?
You know, I go to my doctor a month or so ago for my physical. And he says the same thing he always says, you're the healthiest big guy in my practice. Yeah.
How big are you?
That's of today, 252. A month ago, I was 266. And he checks me out, and then he says, come back next week, and we'll go over the blood work. But he calls me the next morning and says, you need to come back today. And I was like, wow. And he said, I'm 63, and nothing wrong with me, but I have sugar. It was 159. And so he put me on metformin and told me if I didn't lose 25 pounds, he's going to quit being my doctor. And we're friends. So I start taking metformin and start walking, and like I said, I've lost about 14, 15 pounds.
Congratulations. Congratulations.
Thank you, and I do feel better. But, you know, I have two or three martinis two or three times a week.
Uh-huh, okay.
Yeah. And so a friend of mine says, you can't drink martinis and have sugar.
Uh-huh, sure. Are these two-finger martinis or three-finger martinis?
Oh, probably two-finger martinis.
Okay, just checking.
But you know what I've noticed, and it's bizarre to me, I check my blood sugar every morning, and it ranges now after a month, it ranges in 118, down from 159, mm-hmm. mind you, the 118. But the mornings after I have my martinis, it's in the 90s, high 80s.
Uh-huh.
So I'm thinking I need to drink more.
Uh-huh. That's right. We do it logically. Maybe that's a new treatment for diabetes, two martinis and see how your blood sugar is in the morning. But I don't think so. I don't think that's the case. Alcohol, by the way, is basically metabolized like a sugar. Mm-hmm. That's what it is in the body. And so it's really metabolized the same way. And you may notice that it's different on those days, but you may do things a little differently on those days. You may eat differently, may have less of a carbohydrate load. But alcohol doesn't really – there's no evidence that I've ever seen that alcohol reduces blood sugar. But I want a couple of things. First of all, when your doctor said he would quit being your doctor, but he was your friend, I know what that means.
Yeah, he wasn't serious.
Yeah, he wasn't serious. Yeah. But he was trying to tell you to get serious about weight loss and such. And I do have a suggestion with that. When you have lost, we'll say, 20 pounds, then the question is whether or not you need the metformin at all. And what I often do with patients, if they lose 20 pounds and their blood sugar is good and their hemoglobin A1C, which is an average blood sugar measurement, is good, I'll say, why don't we try you off the medicine, see how you do, and just check your blood sugars. Because sometimes people just do well. They lose 20 pounds and their diabetes is still there, but it's under control with diet and exercise. So I don't think I'm going to recommend the two martini lunch as the treatment. For diabetes. How'd you lose the weight, by the way?
Yeah, I watched what I ate.
Good.
You know, that's more than anything. I quit drinking. I mean, I've never been one to drink soda or mm-hmm. But I just watch what I eat. I haven't had a sweet, I don't think, in a month. And it hasn't hurt me any. But, I literally just watched what I ate. Instead of having the 4 pieces of toast with jelly and bacon in the mornings, I have 1 piece of dry toast.
You know what? You hit it right on the head. You hit it right on the head. 4 pieces of toast with jelly and bacon. You look at that carbohydrate load and how many calories it is. And I'll estimate it's between 400 and 500 calories. And you reduce it to 1 piece of toast, and you've reduced it to about 80 calories. And it's those things that matter when you're trying to lose weight. You know, there are a whole bunch of studies, you know, from Dr. Oz to a whole bunch of books, half the self-help books practically in this country, 30 to 40% are on weight loss. And the answer is eat less food. It's not easy to do.
I would drink 3 or 4 glasses of sweet tea a day.
Uh-huh. Sweet tea.
And now I drink unsweet tea.
Yeah. No, that's a big difference. You know, sweet tea has teaspoon of sugar is 15 calories, tablespoon is 45. Before you know it, it adds up to some real stuff.
I mean, if you drink it 2 or 3, and yeah, a friend told me that. We were having lunch, and he said, stop right now. Just stop on the sweet tea. You'll drink 3 glasses here at lunch. And that helped me a lot. And just the little things more than anything. I just became smarter, a smarter eater. And you said that about the 30 or 40% of books are diet books. The other 30 or 40% are cookbooks.
That's good.
That's very good. Yeah. That's very well. Congratulations. Keep up the good work and let us know what happens as time goes on.
Thank you, and I enjoy listening to both of you fellas.
Yeah, oh, thanks
so
thank
much.
You
we
much.
Appreciate the call. Now, Zorba, I have had maybe 3 martinis in my life, so I'm not an expert.
Yeah.
But I don't believe martinis can be measured by 2 or 3
No,
fingers.
No, but that's the
because
phrase.
There's a martini glass.
Yes.
That's for bourbon.
Oh, that's for bourbon. Yeah. Well, you know what, Tom? You know what, Tom? You have just essentially uncovered how much bourbon I drink, because I don't know the difference between 2-finger bourbon and a 2-finger or 3-finger martini glass.
There isn't a 3-finger martini. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. That's 800-462-7413.
And here it was, I was trying to be hip.
Before our next call, Zorba, we talk about sleepwalking. This is interesting. Sleepwalking may run in the family.
Right. Sleepwalking may run in the family. This was interesting research looking at sleepwalking. And sleepwalking, you know, it can be an issue because there's a danger issue. Sleepwalking, by the way, can be caused by medications, Ambien and Halcyon being the most common medications that cause sleepwalking because people are in a, quote, zombie-like state. And if you go to the net and look it up, it's not an uncommon thing at all. It actually happened to my wife, Penny, once. She was post-surgery, and I gave her an Ambien, and about an hour later, she was downstairs trying to cook eggs, and it was 1 o'clock in the morning. She was going to call her friends on the phone, and I said, honey, let's go back to sleep. And I was able to control her back to sleep and never, ever use that drug again. We were over, one and done, as we like to say. But parents who have been sleepwalkers in the past, particularly if both parents have been sleepwalkers, often have children who sleepwalk too. And sleepwalking begins in childhood, usually disappears by adolescence.
Mm-hmm.
We had one of our kids, Eli, in the family used to sleepwalk. He would sleepwalk into the bedroom. We would talk to him and he would never remember it. And it usually doesn't go into adulthood. But they found that basically if both parents sleepwalked when they were children, that it was much more likely that their kids sleepwalk too. And the issue here is when your children are developing, just making sure that they're in a safe environment. So if you're on the second floor of a house and you sleepwalked, you want to make sure that you have children or young, you want to make sure there's a gate going down the stairs that a child doesn't walk down the stairs and fall when they're younger because they're much more likely to sleepwalk. So kind of interesting stuff.
Were you a sleepwalker?
I am a sleep talker. I am not a sleepwalker. My grandpa, may he rest in peace, was in World War I, had an injury to his right arm, and it was always painful. He'd roll over in his right arm and say a bunch of 4-letter words in his sleep. And I remember I was young. I was about, 6 or 7 years old, and I'd go in there because he'd be talking, and then it would make some sense. And I would, I would try to see what he actually was. You know, was he in a dream? And then, no, he would never answer. Yeah. And then about maybe half an hour later, he would just start talking again and babbling. But there was always a swear word in his babble. Now, were you a sleepwalker?
I was a sleepwalker as a child, as you were just talking about. I have a very, very embarrassing child sleepwalking topic to talk about, which I'll put off for a future program.
Oh, please, come on.
This will give listeners an incentive to stay with us. Maybe not next week. Maybe not next month. At some point,
I'm going to call you on this, Tom. It's going to be Tom's Great Adventure in Sleepwalking.
800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. And Zorba, a Spokane, Washington listener, is with us now. Hi.
Hi, fellas. The question is, orthopedic surgeon versus neurosurgeon.
What's the problem?
Yeah, excellent. Very bright.
The problem has been going on for 3 years. I have 4 bulging discs, 2 herniated discs, and a fractured vertebrae.
How'd you get the fracture? You have an injury?
That's an old fracture. Mm-hmm. It was a childhood abuse. I guess that's the best way to put it.
Okay.
Yeah, I was attacked by my father.
By your father.
When I was about 14. Mm-hmm. I'm 65 now. Oh,
so that was many, many years ago. But here it is. You still have injury from it.
Yeah. So lots of pain. Went to a neurosurgeon who gave me an injection in the back.
Okay.
He said, call me the next day. Tell me how it's doing. I called, talked to the nurse. And the nurse said, the doctor says, don't come back. There's nothing he can do for you.
Okay.
Well, okay, then I found a an x-ray doc, and he gave injections in the back.
Okay.
And so I started getting, I've had about 9 injections in the back over a 3-year period. When I get these injections, usually they call them caudal area, I thought I died and went to heaven. I tell you, the resolution was terrific.
Oh, wonderful.
But more recently, I had an extreme pain on the left-hand side of L4 and L5, ended up in the emergency room, took 4 shots of morphine to get me calm enough to go through the CAT scan, and then doc said, diagnosis? Blew it out good on the left side. So there we go. He sent me to a neurosurgeon.
A different neurosurgeon, I tell
you. That's right, a different neurosurgeon. Okay. The neurosurgeon was very cavalier and said, yep, you got all these problems. You should stick it out just as long as possible, because when we go in there, it's going to be rods and pins and staples and a big job.
Okay.
Okay, so and then he got up and said, "When you decide to do it, let my staff know," and left. Okay. So he was short and sweet and without any compassion at all. So my question is: as I go towards this surgery, would a neurosurgeon or a orthopedic surgeon be best to consult?
Well, let's look at a couple of things here. First of all, once again, you got the short shrift from a physician, which I never like. You know, I don't like that. I think giving the time of day is a very important part of medicine. And being cavalier when it comes to surgery on my back, I wouldn't want anyone to be cavalier. They may be, quote, good with their hands, but, you know, they don't have the time of day. And if I can go to somebody else, I don't go to that person. You know, and frankly, in our area, you know, we don't, you know, it's less common in some areas of the country than it is in others. And if there's only one neurosurgeon around, it tends to be more common, not all the time by any means, or one orthopedic surgeon or so on. Both can be trained in doing back work. So there's no right answer here. There are neurosurgeons who do very good back work, and there are orthopedic surgeons that do back work. They can both have spine fellowships, and they go at it in different ways. In our large medical group, we have neurosurgeons, and we used to have an orthopedic surgeon, and that orthopedic surgeon has since retired, and so we just have neurosurgeons, but for a while we had orthopedic surgeons too that did it, one who did quite a bit. So there's no right or wrong answer here. The issue is whether the surgery is going to be useful or not. That's a big issue. It's not a small issue, and I'll tell you why. If I take people 60 years of age and older going down the street, have no pain at all, take 100 of them, do MRI scans, they don't have any pain, bang, they'll have on the MRI or CAT scan, they'll have a bunch of discs that have problems. I'll give you a good example. Me, I am over the age of 65. I am the happy age of 67. Mm-hmm. And I had to have a CAT scan for a completely different reason. And when the CAT scan came back from my back, everything else was fine. It came back, I've got like a couple of discs here, and this is bulging, and that's out. And the reality is, I don't have much back pain. I have sacroiliac back pain that I've had in my 20s. But you could look at my back and say, oh, my God, you need all this back work done. Well, the answer is I don't. Mm-hmm. So the presence of the abnormality on the scan doesn't mean that is causing the pain. That's the bottom line here. And a neurosurgeon or orthopedic surgeon who says, I don't want to see you until your back is really bad, means they're afraid of going in and making things worse, because a surgeon usually has the view a chance to cut is a chance to cure. So either one is good, either orthopedic surgeon or a neurosurgeon. But I think getting a second opinion before you would have surgery like this, this is important, because it sounds like you have a complex case. And, of course, the injections worked. You can only do them so much because they do have a risk to them. But keeping them up while you're making your decision can be helpful. So I hope this has been helpful on how you walk through the maze of American medicine.
Okay. Well, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
Thank
you.
We appreciate the call. Before the break, Zorba, let's try something new. We recently received some poems from a few listeners.
Oh, poems.
And I think we should share a couple of them on the show. The first poem comes from Tim in Provo, Utah. And Brad, can you cue up some music for this one? Maybe a jazzy bass line or something. I'd like to set the mood for Tim's poem. Okay, here we go. My doctor says to use less salt. My daughter says no pork. My neighbor swears by fish oil, and my spouse chews on raw cork. The fast food joint I patronize has burgers so organic that when I put some ketchup on, the staff calls me satanic. I got a water bottle for my birthday. What's the deal? Plain tap water is good enough. Come on, folks, let's get real. The break room now has apples. Not a Cheeto is in sight. A bag of M&Ms is treated like the chestnut blight. I want a prudent diet, but the factions are so teeming that if I listen to them all, I'll wind up crazed and screaming. Everything's verboten, from vanilla to beef stew. Perhaps, like good old W.C. Fields, I'll just use a corkscrew.
That's hysterical. I love it. I just love it. He certainly summed it up. Politically correct eating is here for a lifetime.
We thank you, Tim. And this lovely poem was sent to us by an 8-year-old named Arden. It's called Inside My Heart. Inside my heart lives one garden full of the food we eat, two purring kittens, three pieces of music, four big smiles, five flying birds, six crawling caterpillars, seven drops of water, 8 years I've been alive, nine planets, and a sea full of joy.
Oh, how wonderful is that?
Is that nice for an 8-year-old?
Wonderful. How creative. How wonderful. It just goes right to my heart.
Thank you, Arden. Have a poem for Zorba. Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have our recipe coming up. You'll want to be with us for that. More of your calls, of course. Some interesting emails again on our Medical Mythbuster here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. 800-462-7413, the number if you have a question for Zorba. But before our next call, Zorba, grilled chicken salad with mango and avocado.
Ooh, it sounds good. It even sounds good to me. Of course, recipes
well, a lot of things sound good to you, especially when they're your recipes.
Yes, that's right. Now, I happen to love avocado. I never ate avocado as a kid. Did your mother ever have avocado?
Oh, no.
So how old were you when you ate your first avocado?
I don't know. 47, maybe.
Oh, my God. It's not that. Jeez. You know what? You're born in 1920 or something like that. But avocados are, you know, associated with Mexican food. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'll get you for that.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, mango, I didn't have mango until, like, college or after college.
Yeah. Neither one of those you eat as a kid.
No, they were not. What were the vegetables? Well, vegetables my mother served were corn.
Yeah.
Beans.
Right.
Peas.
Carrots.
Carrots.
Yeah. That's about it.
Potatoes.
Oh, yeah, of course.
It was like
and
big
And fruits were apple, yeah, orange,
that's right.
Pear.
That's right. Yeah. That was it. And nectarines, maybe, or
no,
something.
No, not nectarines.
Nectarines. There were nectarines. You know, and then the foods I would get rid of would be lima beans.
Yeah, of course.
I remember I would pick the lima beans out of, remember, out of the stuff? I hated lima beans.
Yeah.
But lima beans, super. Well, anyway, that's another story. Let's get on with grilled chicken salad with mango and avocado.
Right.
Start out with 2 tablespoonfuls of extra virgin olive oil.
2 big tea olive oil.
2 tea of fresh lime juice. Do not use reconstituted. It will not taste good.
Yeah. 2 big tea fresh lime juice.
You're going to use mango chutney. That's where the mango comes from. 2 tablespoonfuls of mango chutney.
Yep.
And you can get this at a good grocery store. They'll have it. Tablespoonful of low-sodium soy sauce.
1 tea low-sodium soy sauce.
3/4 teaspoon of grated, peeled, fresh ginger. I take my ginger. I don't peel it. I usually put it in the freezer, and I grate it. And I love ginger, so I would use more than 3/4 teaspoon.
3/4 little tea or more grated, peeled, fresh ginger.
4 4-ounce skinless, boneless chicken breast halves. Okay, so you're going to take 4 of those 4-ouncer chicken halves that are boneless.
Okay.
Skinless. 8 cups of mixed salad greens.
8 cups mixed salad greens.
I would use the pre-mixed. 1 cup of diced peeled mangoes. That's right. So you've got to get a fresh mango. This will be during mango season because mangoes do have a season.
What is their season?
That's a good question. Next.
Next.
Next question. Take 2 aspirin and call me in the morning.
All right.
That's about what I know.
Next ingredient.
But I know at the Asian grocery store I go, I see them. I don't see them in the winter.
Okay.
I see them in the spring.
Well, there you go.
But I haven't paid much attention after that. I'm sorry. 3/4 cup of diced peeled avocado.
3/4 cup diced peeled avocado.
Let's make the recipe. Combine the oil, the olive oil, chutney, mango chutney, low-sodium soy sauce, the grated ginger in a small bowl. Place the chicken on a large plate. Spoon 2 tablespoonfuls of oil over the oil mixture over the chicken, reserving the rest for the salad. Turn the chicken to coat and let it stand for about 5 minutes so the chicken is coated in this. Then place the chicken on a grill rack that is coated with cooking spray and grill it for 4 minutes on each side. You know, so you can do this outside on the barbecue. You could broil it if you want to, but you've got to cook it with the sauce on top of it until the chicken is done, brushing with the oil mixture from time to time. The idea is that this oil mixture will go in the very dry, boneless, skinless chicken breast. That's what you want. Then slice the chicken crosswise into strips. And, of course, you can do this in advance. Everything can be done in advance. So at the next luncheon, you have at your house.
Okay.
For your buds.
Okay.
You could do all this in advance and then just do the prep when they actually come in to play cards. Yeah.
Or
right?
I could call the pizza place.
Call the pizza place, exactly. Yeah. So arrange the greens, mango, and avocado on 4 serving plates. Mm-hmm. Put the chicken over the greens. Drizzle the reserved dressing over the salad. And you've got a wonderful, wonderful salad. Good any time of year, especially during mango season, because it's the only time you're going to be able to get mangoes.
Right. And anybody wants a copy can call you at home?
Yeah, you can call me at home. 1-800-462-7413.
Oh, they could.
You did. You got that. That's our number. That's 1-800-462.
Carl's going to get all these calls.
7413. That's right. Carl can chime in. He'll be happy getting the calls. Right, Carl?
No.
Awesome. Let's get serious.
He can't wait. No, you can go to our website at zorbapastor.org. Or, of course, you can go through Facebook. And don't forget, I tweet at Dr. Zorba.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. That's 800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, let's welcome a listener in Fishburg, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello, Tom and Zorba. My concern today is about my right eye. And I have a diagnosis that I finally got one of the ophthalmologists to put in writing because I didn't understand the words that were being said. It's kind of short. It says, chemosis of right inferior temporal bulbar conjunctiva and Dillon right temporal peripheral cornea.
Uh-huh.
So okay. When I read that,
it's a long diagnosis.
I didn't know what the words meant. Well, I know of and right and so on.
Yeah,
but I didn't know what they meant. So it seems like I have a swollen conjunctiva. I don't know if I'm saying that word correctly or not. But
You are. You get an A.
Well, okay. What are we talking about, Zorba?
He's got the clear covering in front of your eye, not the cornea, but there's sort of a clear covering on top of that is swollen.
And the Dillon is some sort of swelling on the cornea, but that has gone away, I think, because I've increased using artificial tears. So the cornea specialist looked at my eye for just a couple minutes, said, well, we got to do surgery, remove the conjunctiva, and have an MRI, and my assistant here will help you do all that, and I've got to get on to my next patient. So I had it was very scary. I finally looked it up. Some things, and you can't just remove the conjunctiva without doing something. You have to graft tissue on in place of it. It seems rather drastic, and the eye fluctuates from being really good, like it's been for the last couple of weeks, to being pretty bad in dry weather. And the MRI I did have, that was loads of fun, and it showed that I do not have any growth behind my eye that's causing this, so we ruled that out.
Good. So what are you going to do?
Well, I had an appointment to make to have the surgery, but I eventually canceled it at the recommendation of the second ophthalmologist because it was going to be 4 weeks until we leave for a vacation to Europe, which was going to be for 3 weeks. And there might be post-surgery concerns.
And oh, yes.
4 weeks
for
wouldn't be enough time.
Absolutely.
And the coronary surgeon specialist and the regular ophthalmologist both agreed that it wouldn't do damage to my eye if I waited. Almost indefinitely. And so as I did, I also took Lodamax, which seems to have helped.
I'm not familiar with that. What is it?
It's a steroid that attacks the swelling, I think.
Oh, it's a steroid.
Yeah.
So how can I help you?
Well, I don't know what my options are. I don't know what the risk is of having surgery, what the risks are of not having surgery. And the thing that bothers me the most is none of the three ophthalmologists have a clue as to why I have this.
So let me give you some tips on sort of how to maneuver the system. First of all, as sharp and as bright and as intelligent and as handsome and as beautiful as doctors are, the paradigm of virtue, who never make an error and always know everything. In fact, we don't know everything at all, and we think we know everything sometimes, but we don't know it. So you can actually have a disease, and we don't know why you have it. For example, breast cancer. Why do some people get breast cancer and some don't? Lung cancer. Only 10% of smokers get lung cancer. 90% do not. Heart disease. There may be no heart disease in your family, and you don't smoke, and you eat right and everything, and you know, you're like Jim Fix and you know, or somebody else, and you end up getting a heart attack and dying. We don't know a lot of stuff, and we don't know the ideology, the reason behind that. So the fact that they don't know what causes it means it's idiopathic. Idiopathic means we're idiots. We don't know what causes it.
I think one of them used that term.
Idiopathic means it's not there. Now, sometimes we know that there's a cause for it, so we rule that out. So, for instance, pancreatitis, a good example, it's caused by gallstones. It can be caused by viral infections and other things. But a lot of it is idiopathic, again. So there are a lot of things that are idiopathic. That's number one. You may never know, or something may show up. And they wanted to make sure with the MRI that there wasn't anything that was causing it. The real issue is the surgery. Is it necessary or not? Now, it's clear that the corneal specialist did not give you the time of day.
No.
It was slam, bam, thank you, ma'am. That's the kind of stuff. I don't really care for that. And if it were me, I certainly wouldn't have surgery either with that guy. And I would get another opinion. I also, I'm pretty nice but abrupt with that. I also would write them a letter and I would say, you know what, you didn't spend any time with me and I was not happy. Can you tell me why you didn't spend any time? Make it a little uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. If they're a member of a group, then you send it to the president of the group and you say, I'm displeased with this visit because they didn't spend any time. Now, here's step number two. You want a second opinion. No doubt I would get a second opinion because they don't know what's causing it. You've now engaged in conservative therapy. And the question is there any risk of continuing with these eye drops with conservative therapy? We know that steroids cannot be used in the long run. You can use them in the short run, but there's a fear of cataracts in the long run. On the other hand, you said you had cataract surgery.
Yes. Well, I don't have to worry about that,
You don't have to worry about cataracts because that's really the issue. So I think you need a second opinion on conservative treatment with and without steroids. And for that, I would make sure that I went to another corneal specialist. That's what I would do. I'd write the letter, and I'd go somewhere else, and I would consider doing it without the surgery.
That's a bit difficult, I guess, in today's medical environment. I'm on Medicare with a replacement plan, Advantage Plan Medicare.
Yeah.
So it's not easy.
Not easy doesn't mean it's not impossible.
No, it's not impossible.
There are a lot of things that aren't easy. Yeah. If it came to my eyes, I would do something that would be a little bit more difficult. You hit it. It's not easy. It's not like calling up. But you seem to me to be the type of person, since you listen to public radio.
Indeed,
that can actually go forth and do the research on how you get a second opinion. And I know that your plan will allow a second opinion, and that's what I would do. And it's not easy, but a lot of good things in life aren't easy.
Yeah, it's true. Okay, I have one other thing for Tom. He and I have something in common. I am one of those people who does not have an Eiffel. Seemed to be a kind of an interesting point at one point in your conversation, so I thought I'd let Tom know there are others out here that don't have an iPhone.
Oh, okay. There are two of us left.
Yeah, well, I also have a friend who doesn't either, and we're probably all about the same age.
We ought to get together.
Yeah.
We should talk without looking at something while we're talking to
That's exactly the way I feel.
Zorba. Thanks for your call.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks a lot. We appreciate the call at 800-462-7413.
All you Luddites are alike. That's all I can say.
And before the break, Zorba, let's take an email question from Anne in Pocatello, Idaho. She writes, "Hello, Zorba and Tom. My 17-year-old son has read that people perform better when they sleep 4 to 5 hours a night and then take naps throughout the day. Now that school is out, he's sleeping from 5 a.m. until 10 a.m. and then trying to catch naps as he can during the afternoon. However, when he doesn't have a reason to be up earlier in the day, he will sleep from 7 a.m. to 4 p.m. the next afternoon. He's an experimental guy by nature and a night owl. I'm worried that this irregular sleep might be bad for his physical and/or mental health. What do you think? And thanks for your advice and your fun, informative show."
That's very nice. That's very nice. Well, first of all, 7 a.m. to 4 p.m., clearly he's the guy who you want to have on from 12 to 7, from midnight to 7 o'clock in the morning, that kind of a guy, because he's a night owl. Yeah. Teenagers, by the way, and for the most part young adults, do not have their circadian rhythms etched in stone as do we. I mean, we like to go to sleep at the same time every night. I mean, just because that's the way our brain works as it's fully developed, especially the prefrontal cortex and the hippocampus, which is responsible for these kind of things. It really doesn't make a difference. The natural way, according to some evolutionary biologist, of sleeping is to sleep for about 4 to 6 hours, generally about 6 hours, wake up for half an hour to an hour, and then sleep for another 2 to 3 hours. That's a very natural pattern. And this idea of 8 hours of sleep all at one time really came in with industrialization.
Really?
To get people into factories. You look at people in the bush, and they often are in the middle of, they're living in close quarters with other humans. They don't have a bedroom. They're in the corner. Mm-hmm. And they often wake up during the night, and they're awake for a while, and then they doze back on, just like a lot of us do when we get older, whereas young adults and teenagers can sleep longer. Well, the long and the short of this is, no, they're not doing any harm. We need about 7 to 8 hours of sleep per 24-hour cycle. So for some people, and for most of us, we get the sleep all at one time. And for some of us, that's just not the way our body works. Mm-hmm. And so we'll sleep for 4 to 5 hours and then nap during the day. The problem with older adults, not younger adults, is if they nap too much during the day, they fragment their sleep at night, and that doesn't make them happy. Yeah. So I would say leave him alone. He's doing just fine. And 5 a.m. to 10 a.m. is his sleep pattern. If it works for you, it works for you.
Have a healthy living question for Zorba? Post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Another interesting topic to talk about. That's coming up next. More of your calls and our medical MythBuster 2 right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That number again, if you have a question for Zorba, is 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, some research to talk over.
Yes, leukemia. Leukemia is, you know, of course, the cancer that hits children.
Yeah.
Years ago, when I was a kid, there was absolutely no cure. I still remember a young girl in my class in elementary school, Cheryl Zaslowski, that was her name. And I can remember like it was yesterday, and she was in fourth grade, and she went into the hospital for anemia, and she was dead 2 weeks later.
Terrible.
And it was awful.
Yeah.
Just awful. It was just terrible. And we've made major strides in the treatment of leukemia today. But the question is, why do some kids get leukemia and some kids do not? And are there risk factors we can change? We do it for cardiovascular disease. We do it for colon cancer. We do it for lung disease by staying away from smoking and so on. So this particular study. It was a retrospective study looking at the risk of leukemia and how it related to breast milk. Because breast milk contains many antibodies, immune-strengthening compounds, things of that nature. This was published in JAMA Pediatrics, and they found children who were breastfed for at least 6 months or more had a 20% lower chance of developing leukemia than those who were not breastfed. And so it's interesting. It's not a cause and effect. You know, obviously, we cannot double-blind placebo control
right.
a child with breastfeeding. But it's another reason to breastfed babies.
It's not only interesting. 20% is significant.
It's a significant drop. And when you look at the study recently that came out in the journal The Lancet that showed that there was an increase in IQ. This was a 25-year study in babies who were breastfed. That particular study looked at women who breastfed their babies for a year. When we looked at the reduction of other medical problems that are generally infectious problems, the question is there may even be a reduction in autoimmune diseases. You can see how important breast milk is.
Yeah.
And when I was in medical school, breastfeeding was akin to a communist plot. Hippies breastfed their children. And non-hippies didn't breastfeed their children, they bottle fed.
Well, years ago, it sort of didn't make any difference as far as health is concerned, whether you breastfed or not.
No. And we now know that breastfeeding is important, but there's another side to this. Not all women can breastfeed. I mean, every woman should try to breastfeed, but not all women can breastfeed. So we have to look at that side. It's one of those things that can help your child, but it's not the only thing that can help your child. So if you find you can't breastfeed, especially for 6 months because you have to go back to work or the milk doesn't come in, then you do other things to try to help and keep your child well. But the bottom line of this study is it's another good example about how breastfeeding is important because there are things in breast milk that help protect a baby. And the longer, the better.
800-462-7413, the number to call if you have a question for Zorba. And back to the phones we go now, welcoming a listener in Norman, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Pastor. Thank you so much for taking my call today.
How can we help?
Well, I have a question about a diagnosis I just received. I've been having pain in my back and my hips. I was originally diagnosed with a sciatic nerve issue and began physical therapy, That did not help my symptoms, and the symptoms began to progress. And I recently visited an orthopedic surgeon who recommended an MRI. I got the MRI and was told that I have a condition called avascular necrosis in both of my hips.
Mm-hmm.
The orthopedic surgeon has recommended a bilateral total hip replacement. I was shocked at the diagnosis. And so my question for you is really two parts. One is, if you know anything about what causes this condition, I'd be curious to know about that. Mm-hmm. There doesn't seem to be a lot of information out
there. No, there's not a lot of information because in many cases we don't know. Avascular means there's not enough blood supply to the bone tissue. And we know there's certain, you know, we don't really know why most of it actually occurs. And that is a real problem. You know, because we don't know how to really step in and keep it from happening. So this is in both hips. Is that the case?
Yes, it is.
Uh-huh. And you took anti-inflammatory drugs?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Does that help at all? What kind of symptoms are you having?
Really, I have a lot of extreme pain when I stand up in a seated position, getting in and out of the car, mm-hmm. Climbing stairs. And as I said, it's gotten progressively worse.
Oh, sure.
Harder and it's worse in one hip than the other. And do you know, are there any alternatives to total hip replacement?
Yeah, they're few and far between. That's why I asked you about the anti-inflammatories. Because what happens is if without the blood supply, then the bone deteriorates and, you know, everything sort of compresses and the architecture doesn't work and then you get more and more pain. How old are you?
41.
Okay. How long have you had pain? When was the diagnosis made?
The pain started about 9 months ago. Mm-hmm. The diagnosis I recently received was just about 2 weeks ago.
So you've just received. This had to be quite a shock to just receive.
Very much so.
Yeah. You know, because I'm sure you went in and you thought, well, there must be something wrong and they'll give me some medication or something of that nature, make it better. So getting back to the issue, once you have it, once the bone starts getting destroyed, there's very little, if nothing, that you can do about it. I mean, there's anti-inflammatories will help with the pain. And sometimes if you've got osteoporosis, but at 41, you're not going to have it. That can help. Exercise, once again, can help with the pain. Some think that electrical stimulation, although I haven't really seen any data that's compelling, will help rebuild bone, and I really haven't seen it. And the treatment of choice is to have a total hip replacement. Now, on the positive side of this, we are much, much better at total hip replacement than we used to. So on the positive side is we used to say, well, put it off as long as you can because it's only going to last, you know, only going to last for 10 years or 20 years. And there are people who have had hips replaced that last for a long, long, long time. You know, we're talking about 25, 30 years or even longer. So the new hips are better than the old ones. But this, what sort of work you do, this must decrease your quality of life and your ability to work.
Yeah, that's my hope. It's, mm-hmm. You know, it's gotten to the point I have young children and it's very difficult to play with them. Uh-huh. And so my hope is that this will restore my ability.
This will. The surgery works. If I were 41, I had young children, and I had an avascular necrosis, I would say, let's schedule it. I would, of course, choose an orthopedic surgeon who I was really happy with, and I would have them do it. I would choose a hospital that does a lot of total hips. There's some hospitals that do less than others. There are some that are better than others. In your area, you've got lots of great medical institutions that do a great job, and I would have it done. And frankly, because there's no other treatment for this, it's something I would just say, okay, when do I want to recover from the surgery and do the surgery? And I would do it sooner versus later because there's the quality of life issue. You have young children and you want to be able to play with them because that's part of being with young children. So
yeah. Thank you, Dr. Pastor.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it.
Good luck and let us know how the surgery goes, please.
Will do. Yeah.
And we appreciate that call. Thanks so much. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number.
You know, when a shock like this happens to you, all of a sudden you're a young guy, you're 41, you've got some pain, you go to the doctor, they take an x-ray, and you go, oh, my God, what do I have, something serious?
Yeah.
And then the question is, what do I do about it? Is there a conservative way to treat it? In this particular case, there really isn't. And in this case, it's the miracle of total joints device that really impressively improves quality of life. And when I think back to the fact that when I started medical school, total hip replacements were very rare. They weren't done a lot. They weren't very good. They didn't really have the mechanics. And basically, the hips that we have now, you say, oh, my goodness, this is something I can really do to improve my quality of life and play with my children. And now the question is when to do it and how.
Yeah. Time now, Zorba, for our medical myth buster. Today's question comes from a loyal listener named Rosario. She writes, Dear Dr. Zorba, I would like to know if it's true that eating a late-night dinner is bad for you. I've read that you tend to store more fat and thus gain weight if you eat dinner after 7.
I don't think that's the case at all. Now, first of all, let's go to France. Then let's go to Spain. Mm-hmm. How about Italy? And then mm-hmm. let's go to Greece. Mm-hmm. And even maybe into Turkey. And they're all around the Mediterranean Sea, and they all have late-night dinners, and they're not as overweight as Americans are. Then let's go to Germany. Let's go to Holland. Let's go to where the burgers are. You know, the guys, burger, I don't mean hamburgers. I mean the big guys.
Yeah.
They're bigger and bigger, and they eat earlier and earlier. You know, Germany, it's 5 o'clock in the evening. I want my dinner, or 6 o'clock, and they're heavier. So that is a myth. If you eat more food, you become heavier. If you eat less food, you become thinner. And the time you eat it has no relevance at all. It is a myth.
Have a myth you'd like Zorba to weigh in on? Just send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org or post it on Facebook. And don't forget, I tweet.
Let's see if we can help another listener now, Zorba. A listener in Waupaca, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, Zorba, Pastor and Tom. Thanks so much for taking my call. I actually have another nutrition question for you. At the first of the year, I decided to go from my vegetarian diet to a vegan diet. So I no longer take in any animal products at all. And just to make sure I was going about it the right way, I've been logging my food and just making sure that I'm getting in all of my vitamins and minerals, particularly calcium and vitamin B12 and iron, and all of those things have been going awesome. But when I was looking at the data the other day, I noticed that I have not consumed any dietary cholesterol since the beginning of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, you always hear about reducing your cholesterol intake, but is there a medical reason that I need to consume cholesterol?
No, not at all. You manufacture cholesterol yourself. And in fact, people who have cholesterol abnormalities who go on a vegan diet, a strict vegan or vegetarian diet, and we get cholesterol from animal products, what happens is they still produce too much cholesterol. So, no, we don't. We get our elevated cholesterol, which is associated with heart disease, from what we consume and then what we manufacture. And the fact is, you will manufacture your own cholesterol, so you need not worry. If you're on a strict vegan diet, you just have to make sure that you get enough calcium. There's some other issues involved with veganism, and you have to be careful with it. What, by the way, what motivated you to become a vegan? I like to ask that of people. What was the strong
motive? Well, there were several reasons. One of the reasons was I just don't like meat, and uh-huh. I don't like a lot of dairy,
sure.
And so it was
mm-hmm.
kind of a really easy switch. But I also just kind of concerns for the environment,
mm-hmm.
Just kind of sustainability and maybe too how the animal animal food industry is going.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just a really easy decision for me on a health and a moral standpoint. Yeah.
And I think when I talk to people who are vegans, it usually is that. It's usually health on one side, morality on the mm-hmm. other side. When I talk to omnivores, there usually is no morality involved at all. But when it comes to vegans, it's usually both. And it is a stricter diet than vegetarianism. But there's some vegans that are just mostly vegan and just don't eat a lot of dairy products or eggs and so on. So, getting back to the issue, the answer is you'll make your own cholesterol. Make sure you keep up on the calcium.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Yeah,
thank you. We appreciate that call. And before we head out today, Zorba, we don't mind taking our lumps from the grammar police or debating the issues during our disagreeing with the doc segment, but now and then it's nice to hear that we're doing a good job. The following email comes to us from Janny in Buffalo, New York. Hello, Zorba and Tom. I'm writing to tell you that the home remedy for removal of a planter's wart with duct tape worked for me. I used the name brand duct tape, put a piece over the wart, and changed the dressing every 7 to 10 days. It took a long time, but the wart slowly faded, and now it is completely gone. It's great to use a non-invasive home remedy like this and have it work. It was very simple, very cheap, painless, harmless, and did not require a trip to the doctor's office. Thank you very much for such fantastic ideas and advice to cure ailments without having to throw money at Big Pharma. I would rather throw money at the makers of duct tape, since there are so many other uses as well.
That's exactly right. It's wonderful. Yeah, duct tape. So is it duct tape or duct tape?
Duct.
That's right. Yes, but sometimes I'll pronounce that duct tape,
no,
and I'll buy
too.
The
yeah,
duct tape brand
times.
Of
yeah,
duct
yeah.
tape.
Duct
but you've got to pronounce it the right way, otherwise
yeah.
it doesn't work. That's an important part of the remedy.
Right. Ask for duct tape and you get some
told. Doesn't work. Yeah. It's got to be duct.
Is Zorba your MacGyver? Share your story with us. Just send it. Do you know what MacGyver means? Or what the reference is? MacGyver was a TV show.
Oh, it was a TV show.
Where the guy used duct tape.
Oh, he used duct tape all the time.
Yeah.
Oh, my friend Dan uses duct tape all the time. So would he be a MacGyver because he uses duct tape for everything?
I think that's
it. Oh, so the MacGyvers of the world could unite in maybe a daisy chain of duct tapes.
Anyway, what's our email?
Zorba@WPR.org or Facebook.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org or through Facebook.
And you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0627Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.